From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, writing the songs for Fiddler on the Roof, including a new song for the Broadway revival. We talk with composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick. Harvey Fierstein and Rosie O'Donnell currently play the lead roles of Tevye and Goldie. Also, David Edelstein reviews Jarhead, starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Peter Sarsgaard as Marines. And I'll have a preview of the upcoming live broadcast of The West Wing this Sunday night. The cast is staging a one-hour presidential debate. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Broadway revival of Fiddler on the Roof has a new cast member, Rosie O'Donnell in the role of Goldie, opposite Harvey Fierstein's Tevye. Our guests are composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick. They co-wrote the songs for Fiddler on the Roof, as well as for the Broadway musicals Fiorello and She Loves Me. In Fiddler, Tevye is a husband, father, and milkman in Anatevka, a small Jewish village in Tsarist Russia. The year is 1905. Zero Mostel originated the role. When the revival opened last year, Alfred Molina played Tevye. Now, here's Harvey Fierstein as Tevye.
If I were a rich man, bum, all day long I'd bum. If I were a wealthy man, wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a bitty rich, a idle deedle, idle diddle man, I'd build a big tall house with rooms by the dozen right in the middle of the town. A fine tin roof with real wooden floors below. There would be one long staircase just going up and one even longer coming down. And one more leading nowhere just for show.
Fiddler on the Roof opened on Broadway in September 1964 and ran for 3,242 performances, which was, at the time, a Broadway record. It's since been performed around the world. The show's book is by Joseph Stein. Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bock wrote a new song for the new revival at the request of the show's director, David Laveau, to replace the Gossip song. But Harnick and Bock weren't sure they wanted to take on writing a new song. Terry spoke with them in 2004.
What was the perceived problem?
Well, this is Sheldon Harnick speaking. The problem was that the song was supposed to be for the matchmaker, Yenta. The appealing thing, before I tell you the problem, the appealing thing was, as David pointed out, most of the songs in the score deal one way or another with tradition, either the preservation of it or the changing of it. And as David said, you haven't dealt with the tradition of the matchmaker, which was changing at that time. And that's what he wanted us to explore musically. So that was an appealing idea. The problem was, at that point in the show, as a lyricist, I thought, I'm not sure I can find anything for her to say that we haven't already heard. I don't know that there's anything new there. And consequently, as clever as I might be, it still could turn out to be a stage weight. So that was a problem.
Well, here's another issue. You hadn't worked together in nearly 35 years.
No so, problem, not an issue.
Not an issue? How'd you feel about getting back together again? Were you on good terms?
It was like we never, Jerry Bock, it's like we never stopped.
When was the last time you'd spoken? When was the last time you'd actually, been in the same room together?
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
Sheldon.
We've remained friends for the all of our professional life. And even if we hadn't, we would have had to get together because there were constant problems or things to discuss about our previous shows. So we've always had to maintain a relationship. And as it happens, it's been an amiable one.
Jerry Bock, Terry, we weren't divorced. We were romantically separated.
Okay. Well, Sheldon Harnick, tell us about the lyric that you wrote for this new song, Topsy Turvy.
When I confess, when I thought about the problem, my heart sank, but I thought, okay, let's give it a try and see what happens. And I fell into some ideas which I thought, yes, I think this could work. The problem was we were already, if I remember correctly, I think we were 2 weeks into rehearsal.
Yes.
When this happened. So I thought, oh my, it has to be done very quickly. And so I wrote a draft very quickly. And of course, when you write something, you're always, or usually you're quite pleased with what you write. I wrote it. I thought, oh, this is terrific. And I faxed it to Jerry, and Jerry read it, and he said, oh, this is fine. Then during the rest of that day, while Jerry presumably was off writing the music, I looked at the music, at the lyric with a colder eye, and I thought, oh, for heaven's sakes, I've written this so fast, there's practically no form to it. I don't know how Jerry can deal with this. So the next day I called him very contritely and I said, I think I gave you an impossible assignment. Jerry, in effect, said, yes, you did. And we had to start over again.
Bach speaking now, the thing that captured me musically was the possibility of adding what only had been suggested in our score, which was to really deal with the possibility of a klezmer musical background for this particular moment.
So are you saying that there was any more or less of a klezmer sound to this song?
Yes, there is.
More of it.
More,
yeah.
Of it.
More than less.
Okay.
There was another problem.
But less is more.
There was another problem. Actually, it turned out not to be a problem, but we thought it might be. Jenta, at that time, was Barbara Berry, who's a wonderful actor, but we had no idea how musical she was and what kind of demands or challenges she could handle musically. And as I wrote the lyric, I kept thinking, well, let's see. I think these lines, if necessary, can be spoken and they can be handled actorly rather than singerly. So that was a consideration. Then there was another consideration. The number that it replaced, the gossip song, had originally been written actually as a scene change. It was a different physical approach to the show, and we needed something while a new set was being put into place. So the number, the gossip number, really didn't have too much to do with the show. What it did have was energy and humor. And when I looked at the score in the second act, I thought the energy and the vitality of that number are necessary because much of the second act score, while being, I think, very beautiful, is also rather gentle, rather lyrical. So when we approached the song for Jenta, we thought we have to preserve that feeling of animation. Then it was a time-consuming, give-and-take approach. I would give Jerry a lyric, and he was able to set the choruses but not the verses. And then Joe Stein came into it, our book writer, and Joe read what we were doing, and he had his comments, and some of them were negative, so I had to throw out certain things that I'd written and start over. What Jerry did, which actually solved the problem eventually of the verses, rather than trying futilely to set what I had given him, which I think was unsettable, he wrote some music and said, how's this? And when I listened to the music, the first thing I thought was, oh dear, what can I salvage? What that I already have is going to fit this music? And luckily, much of what I'd written fit it.
So Barbara Berry was going to be, you mentioned this was written initially with Barbara Berry in mind, but she didn't actually make it to the show, and Nancy Opel sings the part of the matchmaker. So why don't we hear Nancy Opel singing the part of the matchmaker in the new cast recording of Fiddler on the Roof?
Love to.
It's all topsy-turvy. No? Yes. The world is a shambles.
A mishmash.
It's a mess.
We all have our troubles. Right?
Right.
And mine is my living. It changed overnight. And why? I'll tell you why. Young people, all of a sudden, everyone knows better than me. Who needs Jenta? Why come to me when more and more they don't want marriage?
No.
No, it seems today they all insist on wedded bliss. A simple match is not for them. They'll only marry for love.
They want to be happy.
They want to be happy. What kind of match is this?
It's all topsy-turvy.
Right? Right. The world is a riddle.
A muddle.
And a blight. The matchmaking business finished. Done.
But still, count your blessings.
I counted. None. Young people, they're all crazy.
That's Topsy-Turvy, a new song composed by Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bock for the new revival of Fiddler on the Roof, and the cast recording of that revival has just come out. How did you first start writing together? Well, I should mention that the other shows that you've done include Fiorello and She Loves Me.
Jerry was with a publisher named Tommy Volando, and he was looking for a lyricist. And Tommy knew my work from the reviews to which I had contributed songs. And it was Tommy Volando who put us together. We had actually met socially. I was called in to try and repair lyrics or add new lyrics to a show called Shangri-La. And in the show was Jack Cassidy.
Jack Cassidy, Bach here, was our matchmaker.
Yes.
He introduced us, and slowly and surely we began to get to know each other, and both ended up in Tommy Volando's office, who made it a professional arrangement that we would become a words and music team.
Lyricist Sheldon Harnick and composer Jerry Bock. They wrote the songs for Fiddler on the Roof. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick. They wrote the songs for Fiddler on the Roof, which is now in revival on Broadway.
Jerry Bock, when you were writing the music for Fiddler on the Roof, how Jewish did you want the music to sound? How much did you want it to sound like klezmer music, and how much did you want it to sound like Broadway music?
It never entered my mind in either case. I knew the ambience was going to be Russian, and that it took place in a shtetl, but I had no compulsion to research either early klezmer or particularly Russian music at the turn of that century or just before the turn of the century. What happened was that for some inexplicable reason, the music that I hadn't been able to write with all our shows was something that I had silently deposited in my creative mind, and the opportunity to now express myself with that kind of music just opened up a flood of possibilities for me.
Well,
the only piece of music that I can think of that was definitely influenced by some Jewish music was If I Were a Rich Man, because Jerry and I had gone down to see a Hebrew Actors Union benefit. We went down looking to see whether there were any performers in that would be useful for our show. And there was one. There was a man named Tzvi Schuller who became our innkeeper. But as part of the entertainment, a mother and daughter came out, and they did a Hasidic chant, all in thirds and sixths, with just syllables, no actual words. And Jerry called me the next day saying he'd been so taken with this that it's inspired him to write something similar.
And that was a collaborative thing again, because what affected us was both the word chant as well as the accompanying music. But once again, I think we converted it into our own variation of same.
Right.
Well, Sheldon
Harnick, it's only part. I don't want to put it down because I think it's a surprising part and an endearing part of the whole song, If I Were a Rich Man.
Well, I'm going to play If I Were a Rich Man, and this is the only track that I'm going to play from the original cast recording because Zero Mostel is so famous for how he interpreted this song. So let's hear Zero Mostel from the original cast recording doing If I Were a Rich Man.
Dear God, you made many, many poor people. I realize, of course, that it's no shame to be poor, but it's no great honor either. So what would have been so terrible if I had a small fortune? If I were a rich man,
All day long I'd biddy biddy bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a biddy biddy rich, idle diddle 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 man, I'd build a big tall house with rooms by the dozen right in the middle of the town. A fine tin roof with a real wooden floors below. There couldn't be one long staircase just going up and one even longer coming down. And one more leading nowhere just for show. I'd fill my yard with chicks and turkeys and geese and ducks for the town to see and hear, squawking just as noisily as they can. And each loud will land like a trumpet on the ear, as if to say here lives a wealthy man. If I were a rich man.
Azira Mustel from the original cast recording doing If I Were a Rich Man. There's a new cast recording from the new revival that's out, and we'll hear more from that in a moment. My guests are Sheldon Harnick, who wrote the lyrics to the show, and Jerry Bock, who wrote the music. And by the way, they wrote a new song for the new revival. Sheldon Harnick, the yidle deedle digga digga doo part.
Right.
Did you actually write out the syllables that you wanted Zero Mustel to sing?
Well, it wasn't that I necessarily wrote them for Zero, but what happened was this. When Jerry played me the music he wrote, he did the whole song in that kind of a Hasidic chant. And we decided that it would be great fun to preserve part of the chant and not just to write wall-to-wall lyrics for the song. But my problem was, I don't come from a background where I was comfortable chanting in that fashion. And I thought, okay, I'll have to create some kind of syllables which give the effect of that kind of chanting. And I came up with the didle deedle didle digga digga deedle didle dum, which I thought was kind of fun and sounded a little like the chanting. But when we played the song for Zero, he said, I come from a background. I don't want to do the syllables you've written. Is it okay with you if I do it the way I think it should be done? And I said, absolutely. I said, I can't sing it that way. So Zero did it with his stylistically. It sounded quite
authentic.
Authentic, yeah. So when I perform the song, I have to do it with the syllables because that's the only way I can sing it.
By the way, if Sheldon had said no, absolutely not, you must do the lyric, he would have done it. He would have done it his way anyway.
Right?
Was he hard or easier to work with?
He was
both.
In terms of music, he was although he was not a singer, he was extremely musical.
Yes.
So that in that sense, he was very easy. And as a matter of fact, he did me a huge favor. After he started to learn If I Were a Rich Man, I got nervous about it because I thought most of the song is rather droll, and then I went for a serious ending, and I began to worry whether I should change the ending and make the ending droll also. So I suggested that in a conference we had one day. I think Hal Prince was there and Jerome Robbins and Zero. And Zero looked at me and said, Sheldon, he said, don't change the ending. If you want to, this is the man. He said, it's the jokes in the song are terrific, but this is the man that you've described, the man who wants a seat by the Eastern Wall, who wants to be able to pray. This is the real Tevye. So he saved, and we kept the ending, and I'm glad we did.
I'm glad, too.
Lyricist Sheldon Harnick and composer Jerry Bock speaking with Terry Gross last year. We'll continue with our interview in the second half of the show. The revival of Fiddler on the Roof now stars Harvey Fierstein and Rosie O'Donnell. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air. Thank you.
A fiddler on the roof. Sounds crazy, no? But in our little village of Anatevka, you might say every one of us is a fiddler on the roof, trying to scratch out a pleasant, simple tune without breaking his neck. It isn't easy. You may ask, why do we stay up here if it's so dangerous? We stay because Anatevka is our home. And how do we keep our balance? That I can tell you in a word. Tradition!
Tradition! Tradition! Tradition! Tradition! Tradition!
Because of our traditions, we've kept our balance for many, many years. Here in Anatevka, we have traditions for everything. How to eat, how to sleep, how to wear clothes. For instance, we always keep our heads covered and always wear a little prayer shawl. This shows our constant devotion to God. You may ask, how did this tradition start? I'll tell you. I don't know. But it's a tradition. And because of our traditions, every one of us knows who he is and what God expects him to do.
Who day and night must scramble for a living, feed a wife and children, say his daily prayers, and who has the right, as master of the house, to have the final word at home? The Papa! The Papa! Tradition! The Papa!
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and Barnes & Noble, featuring Secrets of the Widow's Son by David Shugarts, a look at the upcoming sequel to The Da Vinci Code. Additional support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of No True Glory, a frontline account of the battle for Fallujah by Bing West, co-author of The March Up. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with songwriters Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bock about Fiddler on the Roof. David Edelstein reviews the new movie Jarhead, and we'll get a preview of the upcoming live episode of The West Wing. It airs this Sunday on NBC. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross, back with composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick. They wrote the songs for Fiddler on the Roof, which was revived on Broadway last year. Since then, Harvey Fierstein has taken over the role of Tevye and Rosie O'Donnell the role of Goldie. Here's one of the show's most popular songs, To Life, performed by Alfred Molina as Tevye and David Wall as the butcher, Lazar Wolf.
Let's drink on it.
Why not? To you.
No, my friend. To you.
To the both of us.
To our agreement.
To our agreement. To our prosperity. To good health and happiness. But most important, to life, to life, l'chaim.
L'chaim, l'chaim, to life.
Here's to the father I've tried to be.
Here's to my bride-to-be.
drink l'chaim to life, l'chaim. L'chaim, l'chaim to life.
Life has a way of confusing us,
blessing and bruising us. Drink l'chaim to life.
God would like us to be joyful, even when our hearts lie panting on the floor.
How much more can we be joyful when there's really something to be joyful for?
To life, l'chaim.
To title my daughter,
my wife. It gives you something to think about,
something to drink about.
Drink l'chaim to life.
Remorka.
Yes, Laser Wolf.
Drinks for everybody.
Music from the new cast recording of Fiddler on the Roof. And my guests are Jerry Bock, who wrote the music, and Sheldon Harnick, who wrote the lyrics. They also collaborated on other shows, including Fiorello and She Loves Me. This is the only song that actually has a Yiddish word in it, l'chaim, which is a toast to life. So, Sheldon Harnick, when you were writing the lyrics, it seems to me you intentionally avoided using anything Yiddish, with the exception of this song.
Well, there is one other song. The Dream uses the word mazel tov.
Oh, that's true. A blessing on your head, mazel tov, mazel tov.
Well, there was a reason for that. Not too long before we went into rehearsal, I went to see a comedian named Lenny Bruce. I'd heard that Lenny Bruce was controversial because he used a lot of profanity and obscenities in his act. And I was curious. So I went to see him. And it turned out that the obscenities and the profanities were all done as characters that he portrayed, and so that they sounded like things those particular characters would actually say. And I wasn't disturbed by the profanity or the obscenity at all. What did disturb me was that when he wasn't doing the characters and he was just talking, he would throw in Yiddish words. And they would elicit laughter from a few people here and there, but many of the other people in the club turned to each other and said, "What did he say? What did he say?" So I thought it'll be probably useful to use a couple of Yiddish words in our show, in the dialogue and in the lyrics, just a couple for flavoring. But if anyone laughs when they're used, then they come out. And also, when they're used, they have to be used in a way that the audience will know what they mean. So, of course, into life, there's an explanation that goes along with the Yiddish word. Right. to life, l'chaim, l'chaim. Nobody can miss that. And the word mazel tov is usually used in a setting where it's pretty clear that it means congratulations.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Good fortune.
Unhappily, after the show is running, the original show is running, our dear star Zero would occasionally go into a matinee and use more Yiddish than we ever could have dreamed of in certain performances to sort of make him a confidant of what he thought that kind of audience was. We all thought that was naughty, to put it mildly.
Did you yell at him afterwards?
Yes. Yes. Joe Stein made a terrible mistake one day. We were in the audience when he used a kind of really naughty Yiddish word. And we went backstage, and Joe said to him, he said, "Zero, you're wonderful today. Buddy Hackett couldn't have done it better." And Zero was furious, and he said, "What do you mean by that?" And Joe said, Zero, do you have to add those kind of words, especially the words that have the naughty implications?" And Zero kind of did what he wanted. So yeah. It was another 2 weeks before he would take those words out. And then when he thought, okay, I've done it enough, then he took it out. So that answers your question. Yes, he was difficult, but audiences adored him.
Our guests are lyricist Sheldon Harnick and composer Jerry Bock. They wrote the songs for Fiddler on the Roof. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick. The new cast recording of Fiddler on the Roof was released last year, featuring Alfred Molina as Tevye.
Now, I want to go to another song, and that is Do I Love You? And
Do You Love Me?
Do You Love Me?
No, Do You Love
Me? We're very
me?
Flattered.
It's Do You Love Me? Do I Love You? Yes.
So, will we please answer that question?
and this is a song, all of Tevye's daughters, like, they want to fall in love. They don't want Tevye to set up. They don't want their father Tevye to decide who they're going to marry. They don't want the matchmaker to decide it. At this point, they want to fall in love, and at least one of them already has. And she wants to marry the man she loves. And this is leading Tevye to wonder, well, what about his relationship? Does his wife love him? What is love? And he sings the song, and it's a lovely song. Sheldon Harnick, can you talk about the lyric?
Yes. During rehearsal, when we were in New York, I began to feel that there was a song that would develop out of Tevye's saying, "Do you love me?" I always thought when Golda would say, "Do I what?" Because that was... love was not something that people married for generally in those days. They married for security. They married for economic reasons, companionship, but not love. So when I pictured her saying, "Do I what?" I thought, that's very funny. But I couldn't figure out where the song went from there. And when we got to Detroit, our pre-Broadway tour, I used to take long walks every day and try and figure out what they would say. And the lyric came very slowly and in a kind of unconventional form. When I finally finished it, after about a week, I gave it to Jerry, very uncertain about what I had. And I said, I know that it looks more like a scene than a song, so do what you can with it, and if I have to rewrite the lyric, I will. And I was absolutely delighted when Jerry set the lyric exactly as I gave it to him.
I just wanted to add very quickly, Terry, that the difference between Zero's "Do You Love Me" and Alfred's is astonishing. Zero did get laughs. He approached it as almost a kind of incredulous question to ask, and took advantage of every humorous possibility. Alfred does it most sincerely. In terms of a true and real question, he wants to know the answer, and as a result, it's a very moving moment rather than a humorous one in this current production.
Yeah, and while we're on that subject, I just have to put in a word that our Golda, Randy Graff, is in her own way, she's as wonderful as Fred Molina is.
Yes.
Well, let's hear Alfred Molina and Randy Graff from the new cast recording of Fiddler on the Roof. This is Do You Love Me?
Golda. Do you love me?
Do I what?
Do you love me?
Do I love you? With our daughters getting married and this trouble in the town, you're upset, you're worn out. Go inside, go lie down. Maybe it's indigestion.
Golda, I'm asking you a question. Do you love me?
You're a fool.
I know. But do you love me?
Do I love you?
Well,
for 25 years I've washed your clothes, cooked your meals, cleaned your house, given you children, milked the cow. After 25 years, why talk about love right now?
Golda, the first time I met you was on our wedding day. I was scared.
I was shy.
I was nervous.
So was I.
But my father and my mother said we'd learn to love each other. Now I'm asking, Golda, do you love me?
I'm your wife.
I know. But do you love me?
Do I love him?
Well,
for 25 years I've lived with him, fought with him, starved with him. 25 years, my bed is his. If that's not love, what is?
Then you love me.
I suppose I do.
And I suppose I love you.
That's that was Do You Love Me from the new cast recording of Fiddler on the Roof. My guests are Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnick, who wrote the music and the lyrics for the show. It's interesting. Some of the songs from the show have had a huge life outside the show, and particularly Sunrise Sunset, which has been sung at countless weddings and bar mitzvahs. But a song like Do You Love Me, I think it's you're unlikely to hear it in a cabaret act or a nightclub or a pop recording or as a jazz standard. And I thought, well, you know, who's ever going to do a song like this? But there is a recording by Cannonball Adderley of the songs from Fiddler on the Roof that's recently been reissued on CD. And it's actually a wonderful recording, and there's a beautiful version of this song that just kind of brings out the melody of it. Have you ever heard it?
Yes, yeah.
We have. Yeah. Cannonball did a whole album.
Exactly. And what did you think about when you heard this? Just as you know, played by jazz musicians. Just as you know,
I thought he approached the score with great respect and with great understanding. I just love what he did.
And by the way, Terry, there's a new jazz album that reaches equal heights, if not more so, by two fairly unknown jazz people. To the outsider, Eddie Lopez and Mark Kramer did a very recently did a jazz version of the score, which I have an extra copy at home for you, Sheldon.
Good! I never heard of it.
well, for now, we'll hear. Do You Love Me from the Cannonball Adderley recording, and this was actually recorded just a month after Fiddler opened in 1964, and it's actually Charles Lloyd featured on saxophone on this track. Mm. Here we go. So that's music from the Cannonball Adderley recording of music from Fiddler on the Roof, which has recently been reissued on CD. And my guests are composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick, who wrote the songs for the show. I want to thank you so much, not only for talking with us, but thank you for all the great songs you've given us. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick wrote the songs for Fiddler on the Roof. We've been playing music from the new Broadway cast recording of the show now playing on Broadway. With their shaved skulls, Marines are often called jarheads, which is also the title of a best-selling memoir by Anthony Swofford about his experiences in the first Gulf War. The book has been turned into a movie starring Jake Gyllenhaal as Swofford, Peter Sarsgaard as his Marine buddy, and Jamie Foxx as their sergeant.
The director Sam Mendes and the screenwriter William Broyles Jr. showed a lot of guts taking on a book like Jarhead. War movies generally build to combat, an explosive release. But Swofford barely engaged with the Iraqis, who were largely taken out by the Air Force from high above. The movie of Jarhead is unusually faithful, so it's worth describing the arc of the book. It centers on the abuse and dehumanization of Swofford and his fellow Marines in boot camp, And then it shifts to the long, long wait in the barren Saudi Arabian desert, in killing heat, with no visible enemy, with the prospect of a poison gas attack at any moment, and with no booze to lighten the psychological load. Swafford's near delirium finally merges with his outrage at what his fellow soldiers had become, at best desensitized, at worst sadistic. And the blackened corpses of Iraqis strewn all over the landscape leave him sickened. Published in 2003, the book ends on a bitter note. The men who, quote, spread good news about war and warriors never fought, Swafford writes. They are liars and cheats, and they gamble with your freedom and your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the reputation of your country. Mendes and Broyles don't go that far in their indictment, which keeps the movie from spilling into diatribe, but might also diminish its punch. The film feels a little detached, maybe because the internal turmoil of its protagonist, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, is so difficult to capture on screen, even with first-person narration. The first half of Jarhead plays like a humanist but diluted Full Metal Jacket, with Jamie Foxx as the sergeant commanding his men essentially to merge with their weapons.
You will repeat after me. This is my rifle.
This is my rifle.
There were many like it, but this one is mine.
There are many like it, but this one is mine.
Without my rifle, I am nothing.
Without my rifle, I am nothing.
Without me, my rifle is nothing.
Without me, my rifle is nothing.
The grunt dies for 15,000 poorly placed rounds. The sniper dies for that one perfect shot.
Hit. Fire. Fire. Fire.
I was hooked.
Mendes and Broyles resist nudging Jarhead into conventional melodrama, and it's far less showy than Mendes's glib Oscar winner American Beauty and his overinflated Road to Perdition. It's worth remembering that he's primarily a theater guy. I liked him much better when I saw a great production he did of Twelfth Night. It's possible that he regards Jarhead as a kind of marshal waiting for Godot. The characters refer to the Marine Corps as the Suck, which translates lots of ways, but suggests a corrosive Beckett-like vacuum. Mendes and cinematographer Roger Deakins create some surreal stage pictures of soldiers against a sky turned a malignant charcoal by distant burning oil wells, of the protagonist sitting beside charred remains of men around what once was a campfire, an image out of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Jarhead's most astonishing scene invokes another war film, Coppola's Apocalypse Now. The Marines watch the movie and whoop with glee during the famous Ride of the Valkyries bombardment, a scene that, of course, is a masterpiece of ambivalence. You're supposed to be appalled by the destruction of what appears to be a peaceful village, yet fired up by the spectacle, the whoosh, the smell of napalm in the morning. But these men are only turned on. They're living to kill. When Swafford's buddy, Troy, played by Peter Sarsgaard, is denied the chance to take out an Iraqi, he goes mad and attacks a senior American officer. As Jarhead's psychological casualty, Sarsgaard is fascinating. As an actor, he's slightly opaque, which means you're never quite sure if he's ironic or serious. So when he blows up here, it's a shocking moment. Jamie Foxx gives the movie a blast of energy, and Dennis Haysbert has a marvelous cameo as a captain who savors a good bowel movement. I have a lot of respect for Jarhead, although there's nothing in it as potent as the opening of the post-Desert Storm movie Three Kings, in which a soldier shoots an Iraqi who might or might not be surrendering. That's fictional, obviously, and Mendes and Broyles were bound by the facts of Swafford's life. The violence in Three Kings got into our blood, whereas Jarhead is more cerebral. Its protagonist sits back and contemplates the carnage, not knowing whether to be relieved or stricken, but knowing something is very wrong.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Coming up, I'll have a preview of this week's West Wing. This is Fresh Air. All season on NBC's The West Wing, two fictional candidates for president, played by Alan Alda and Jimmy Smits, have been jockeying for position and vying for voters. On this Sunday's episode, they mount a one-hour presidential debate, and The West Wing adds to the drama by airing it live. The setup came at the end of last week's show, when Republican Senator Arnold Vinnick, played by Alda, and Democratic Congressman Matt Santos, played by Smits, waited in the wings to be introduced at a dinner held by a religious organization. For once, they were unaccompanied by their respective handlers. And instead of going ahead with plans to attack each other at the podium, the two candidates circled each other backstage, shook hands, and made other plans.
Here we are. Presidential campaign. Grand national debate. Pounding each other on one of the few things we basically agree on.
Well, then let's negotiate now.
Excuse me?
No backroom tactics. You and me, a real debate.
Oh, please.
A real debate. Really.
No negative ads. No attacks in our speeches out there.
If we can have a real debate on the issues, just you and me.
How's Sunday night? The hell of a way to end your campaign.
Oh, I'm just getting started.
Sunday night is almost here, and I love the idea for several reasons. First, there's the renewed energy that this presidential campaign to replace Martin Sheen's President Bartlet has given to the West Wing. Even though I hate the way the show has mistreated some of its veteran characters, especially Toby and Leo, I really like the way it's laid bare the behind-the-scenes political process of running a campaign, not just from one side of the political fence, but from both. Another thing I love about this debate idea is that it shifts the focus from the people behind the candidates and puts it squarely on the politicians themselves. Alan Alda, by playing Hawkeye in MASH, has about as much residual goodwill as anyone on television. So does Jimmy Smits by dying with dignity as Bobby Simone on NYPD Blue. These guys have the gravitas and the clout to go head-to-head like this. And they're going live, which tests them as actors and rewards us as viewers. There's another reward, too. People watching this weekend's The West Wing will see a debate, moderated by Forrest Sawyer, that's a far different animal than the increasingly constrained presidential debates we've seen since John Kennedy faced Richard Nixon in 1960. If viewers like what they see, how candidates not only are encouraged to rebut one another directly and repeatedly, but are forced to, perhaps this fictional NBC drama will spark a debate about the nature of real debates. Just maybe, like having a woman in the Oval Office on Commander-in-Chief, it can hint at another way of doing things in Washington. But to me, the biggest reward of all is that live television is, well, live and well. When TV began, there was no choice but to go live. There was no other way. But back in the day when there were only three networks, four if you count DuMont, and no cable, reputations could be made overnight by a live drama that riveted and moved people. Paddy Chayefsky became TV's first superstar writer thanks to Marty, his 1953 Goodyear TV Playhouse drama starring Rod Steiger as a lonely butcher. In 1955, 50 years ago, Kraft Television Theater presented Patterns, an amazingly prescient drama about the ruthless way corporate executives treasured stockholders more than workers. The day after it was televised, its author was an instant smash. His name? Rod Serling. These days, though, going live in prime time is an absolute rarity. The biggest champion of live TV the last 10 years has been, of all people, George Clooney. He starred in a live episode of ER in 1998, an episode produced by John Wells, who also produces the upcoming live installment of The West Wing. Clooney also mounted a live TV remake of the movie Failsafe in 2000 and has announced plans to remake another movie as a live TV drama next year. The movie is Network, written, fittingly, by Patty Chayefsky. Add to that Clooney's brilliant recreation of Edward R. Murrow's attack on Senator Joe McCarthy in the movie Good Night and Good Luck, a movie celebrating the CBS News magazine See It Now and one of the most important half hours of live TV ever broadcast, and it's easy to see that live television is in Clooney's bones. I actually wish he'd go one better and oversee and host a quarterly series of live TV drama specials. Remake some old ones, like Patterns and 12 Angry Men. Make some new ones. Build an audience. Revel in the excitement and the uniqueness of live TV. For now, we'll have to settle for The West Wing. But I'm not complaining. I can't wait. Even though this time, I have to. Although I'm a TV critic, there's no preview tape to watch. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. And from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at TIAACREF.org/greatergood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hey, good looking. What you got cooking? How's about cooking some up with me?
On the next Fresh Air, young, beautiful, and secretly gay in Hollywood. We'll talk with Tab Hunter. And Robert Hoffler tells all about the pretty boys of Agent Henry Wilson. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I got a hot rod Ford and a $2 bill. I know a spot.